Hey, it's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. There was a lot of talk about the phrase flattening the curve in the early days of the novel coronavirus. The idea was to try to reduce the spiking number of infections to give hospitals and vaccine developers a chance to catch up. In his new book, our next guest looks at another much bigger disease curve that has been flattening over a much longer period of time. The cycle of infectious diseases killing off huge parts of populations for millennia. He says we're in a much better place now, but we've got to be careful about where we go next. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How have you been reflecting on the coronavirus pandemic as it compares to other historic outbreaks of infectious diseases? Do you have thoughts on what we could do to be better prepared as a state, a country, a world for whatever the next infectious disease might look like? Do you have a question about the history? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Charles Kenny is senior fellow at the Center for Global Development in Washington, D.C. He's authored the book The Upside of Down, Why the Rise of the Rest is Good for the West. His latest book is called The Plague Cycle, The Unending War Between Humanity and Infectious Disease. Charles, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Good to be back with you.
A lot of us have been thinking about global disease for the last year and a half. You started thinking about it a lot earlier because this book was a few years in the making before we even heard of COVID-19. What got you thinking about this broad scope, this broad sweep of our disease history?
I'm interested in global progress. I work in global development and used to work at the World Bank and now work in this think tank that thinks about how we can speed global progress. And if you look at sort of the most unarguable statement about the improving condition of humanity, I think it involves children. We have gone from a world where the average parent would expect to bury at least one of their children before the age of five, to that being a rarity worldwide. We've gone from sort of half of children dying young to about 1 in 25 worldwide over the last two centuries, pardon me. And you look at that statistic, you look from us going from this tragic situation where it is expected to bury a child to that being an all too frequent but still far rarer tragedy today. And you ask why, and the answer is decline in infectious disease. So I became very interested in why was it declining? You know, what was the story behind that? What was going on? And was there a risk of backtracking? The last sort of 18 months, 2 years sort of helps answer the second part of that question. I started in on the research before COVID-19 began, as you suggested.
Looking at the first part of that story, can you talk about, you share examples in your book of a lot of major historical plagues, the actual plague and other things we might call plagues. Talk about just what a huge factor in individual lives and even the grand sweep of human society disease was until really just, a couple hundred years ago?
Absolutely. It sort of drove the entire nature of the world economy, if you will. So basically, civilization is a disaster for human health, to put it bluntly, because what agriculture and civilization did was it took a bunch of humans who were hunter-gatherers and it stuck them much closer together at much higher density with a lot of animals who fostered diseases that could jump species, much like we think probably COVID-19 jumped species from bats. Other diseases jump species from our domesticated animals. So, pigs and chickens get flu and so on. Cows get something akin to measles. So packing a whole load of people very close together in constant contact with their animals led to a firestorm of disease and hugely increased young mortality and infant mortality. That alone had a big effect, not least on women who just in order to keep sort of populations constant, the average woman had to have sort of six or seven children. Half of them got pregnancy-related illnesses. Many of them, sadly died during pregnancy and childbirth. So, hugely bad for humans in general. They saw worse health outcomes. in particular bad for women. And infection was such a burden that it basically, you know, stopped empire spreading, stopped cities getting bigger, because the bigger cities got, the more they became death traps, you know, the more infection killed. And so there was sort of a limit to how large cities could get, and a limit to how large civilizations could get. Rome grew to be one of the largest empires in world history, but was felled not least by the first appearance of Yersinia pestis, the plague of the Black Death, you know, which sort of wiped out large parts of the population of the Roman Empire, and in particular large parts of the Roman army, and, you know, was one factor in the continuing decline of Rome. And 800, 900 years later, you see the cycle repeat with the Black Death, wiping out a third to a half of the population of Europe. And it's only with our advances against infection, it's only with proper sanitation systems, public health laws and regulations, and in particular the sort of the medical revolution of vaccines and antibiotics and so on, that we've managed to push down this burden of disease in such a way that nowadays cities are healthier places to live than rural areas worldwide. On average, city dwellers live longer than rural populations. Nowadays, traveling to another country is not a death sentence like it used to be. It's what's allowed for global cities like, you know, New York or London, with their populations of 10, 15 million, a third of whom come from other countries. It's, you know, the only thing that allows those cities to survive and be the creative centers of the global economy today. And it's the only thing that's allowed for a revolution in women's rights as well. You know, if you don't have to have 7 or 8 children per woman in order just to keep populations constant, if you can get that down to, you know, 2, close to 2 as it is worldwide today, that frees up a lot of time that women were spending, you know, in pregnancy and childbirth, but also, you know, massively improves their health, massively improves their possibility to take, you know, equal part in society in general. So it has all sorts of effects on the global economy. It improves education outcomes, encourages people to get more educated. I could go on, but it really is a vital part of a story that takes us from a world where most people are living in extreme poverty, most children are dying in childhood, to a world where most people are living, you know, on incomes multiples of what they used to, and most people are living, you know, past the age of 70.
Talking to Charles Kenny about his new book, The Plague Cycle, The Unending War Between Humanity and Infectious Disease. You could join the conversation with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Charles, you worry in your book about some very particular risks we have of disease, but also more generally, I think, of a kind of complacency. A lot of us in the world now grow out without that daily risk of horrific infectious disease outbreaks, and maybe we're letting our guard down.
I think that really is a large risk. You know, even today, even after what we've gone through in the last 2 years, we see complacency around making sure the world as a whole works together to reduce the, you know, future risk of new pandemics, but also to sort of finish the job of wiping out infections that are still killing millions worldwide. Just to take some examples, if you look at tuberculosis, malaria, and HIV, last year their death toll was probably about the same as the official death toll from COVID-19. Now, COVID-19 actually killed more people than the official death toll. But HIV, malaria, and TB have been killing that many year in, year out, killing it more than that many year in, year out, you know, for decades. And we've sort of let them fester because they kill poor people in poor countries. And so we sort of, you know, largely, I'm afraid, as a global society, don't particularly care. We use antibiotics at the moment, these magical, magical weapons against bacterial infection. 90% of antibiotics we have, we don't use to cure humans from infectious disease. We use them in order to make factory-farmed animals grow a bit fatter, a bit faster. The risk of developing antibiotic resistant diseases amongst those animals that can then jump species to humans is huge. But you know, because we like our cheap meat, we're willing to take that risk. So in all sorts of different ways, we're acting as if, you know, we don't care, we don't see the threat, and we're still doing it today. I mean, just to take an example, the Build Back Better bill that is still going through Congress, you know, partially as a pandemic response, it's been cut down from its original size. But one of the things that's been most cut in it, it's been cut by 2/3 of the pandemic response measures in it. You know, we're still in the middle of a pandemic that's killing thousands of Americans a week, and yet already we're sort of cutting back, reducing our ambition when it comes around to pandemic preparedness. So I agree. I think there is this sort of this problem of success we face, that in a world where, you know, half the population was dying from infectious disease, it was really hard to ignore. Now we're in a world where, thanks to medical progress and thanks to public health, that doesn't happen anymore. We do seem to be sort of reasonably blasé about the deaths that remain and the threat of many more deaths in the future.
We're talking to Charles Kenny about his new book, The Plague Cycle, The Unending War Between Humanity and Infectious Disease. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. We're going to look at some of what our guest says are lessons for the future from COVID-19 and past diseases. Do you have thoughts? Do you want to see more effort put into public health here in the United States or into curing diseases around the world, even if they don't affect the U.S. Directly? Do you think there are things we could have done better with COVID-19 that maybe with the next pandemic, whatever it might look like, we could do better next time around? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
Wisconsin Public Radio stays connected with the whole state thanks to its network of 7 bureaus. With reporters on the ground across Wisconsin, WPR provides a news service that connects with issues that matter to your life. Stay in touch with WPR.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Charles Kenny from the Center for Global Development. We're looking at his new book. It's called The Plague Cycle, The Unending War Between Humanity and Infectious Disease, looking at lessons from all of human history, plus the latest with COVID-19, lessons that can help us avoid going back to the bad old days when infectious disease was a very real threat to daily human life and even civilizations. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Is there a lesson you hope, say, American policymakers can learn from COVID-19 and the response there? Do you have a question for our guest about disease and history? And on a personal note, how about, I know our guest is curious, how about those COVID booster shots? Are you going to get one if you've already been vaccinated? Do you worry about the choice, you getting a booster or somebody getting their first shot in a poorer country? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Charles, I understand that is something that's on your mind. Some in the U.S. getting their third shots, a lot of countries around the world waiting for their first shots for people.
Yeah, I should admit, I got my third shot. I'm in a slightly higher risk group, thanks to a heart condition. And so I was, you know, in the list that the CDC said, maybe you want to get a third shot. And I did. But as I got my third shot, as I sat there feeling incredibly grateful for medical progress and for these vaccines, you know, I couldn't help but think about the vast majority of people, even in high-risk groups in low-income countries worldwide, that haven't had their first shot yet. We are managing this vaccine rollout in a better way than we've ever done in history before, by which I mean it looks like the whole world will get to, you know, 50-60% vaccinated way faster than we managed with smallpox or with measles or with diphtheria or pertussis or tetanus. Sort of name your previous vaccine rollout effort. We're gonna get from 0 to 60-ish faster than ever before. In that way, it's a great global triumph. On the other hand, it is terrible how badly we've done compared to how well we could have done. Rich countries, including the United States, are sitting on so many vaccines that they're expiring before we can use them. Meanwhile, in poor countries, terribly, you know, high-risk communities, you know, the very old and so on, are sitting there without a vaccine, access to a vaccine at all. It's just sort of, it's morally wrong, it's repugnant. And so, you know, I did the selfish thing. I protected myself a bit more. I wish the system was better set up so, you know, next time we vaccinate more people more faster and much more equitably, you know, in particular, vaccinating those who need the vaccine most first.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Catherine is with us in Menominee Falls. Catherine, hi.
Hi. I guess you're speaking to a pretty biased person here, but I have sincere concerns for people who have had difficulty with COVID, but we lost four family members to cancer in the last 5 years, including my beloved husband. And I cannot believe that there's no cure for cancer when we've had we have never had a sitting president in this country with cancer.
Catherine, thank you so much. I'm so sorry for your loss and your family there. Cancer is a different kind of disease, Charles. It's not as, I guess, some kinds of cancer can relate to certain kinds of infection. I'm thinking HPV here, but it operates differently than the infectious diseases you're talking about.
It does. And I join you in being terribly sorry for the listeners' loss. Cancer is now, you know, one of the greatest killers in the United States, one of the greatest killers worldwide. Because infectious disease deaths have gone down so much, sadly, people still die in the end, and more are dying from cancer and heart disease. I too have experienced some recent losses from both, and I don't mean to, you know, downplay the horror, and I think we do need to make more rapid progress against those diseases, and I think that too should be very much a public health priority. And as we make further advances against infection, you know, even more of a public health priority than it is today. As you say, some cancers can be prevented by vaccines, and HPV is one example where we've seen, you know, really dramatic recent evidence of the efficacy of vaccines in saving lives against some cancers. And I hope maybe one of the silver linings that comes out of the COVID-19 period and the research into these new types of vaccines like the mRNA vaccines is that we see more cancers that can be treated by vaccines. We see more vaccines developed against them. That'll only be, you know, one part of the story of the fight against cancer. But I hope it's a part of a story that's been given a boost by the last 2 years.
Catherine, thanks for that call. We're talking to Charles Kenny about his new book called The Plague Cycle, The Unending War Between Humanity and Infectious Disease. Charles, I want to get another prescription for the future that you're looking for. You mentioned reining in the use of antibiotics, especially among animals, as one cure, investing in public health or not stopping our investments in public health. You're also hoping to see more and more effective international communication on diseases. What would that look like?
At the moment, the World Health Organization, our sort of, you know, international body that's meant to look after global health, its core budget is about the same as one large US hospital. It's a really underfunded part of the global architecture. And I know it doesn't do everything perfectly right, far from it. And I think it really made some mistakes in its early calls on things like masking, suggesting that maybe masking wasn't a priority during the COVID-19 pandemic. And, you know, you can argue forever about what it said about where the virus came from, but it still plays a vital role in coordination. Even during COVID-19, it played a really important role in coordinating trials of various treatments against COVID-19. those trials can run faster if they take place where there's a lot of COVID-19 infection going on. And so being able to move trials around the world to sort of where the pandemic is at that stage is a really powerful way to increase the accuracy and speed of our trials of potential cures and vaccines and so on. So there's just a really big role for better international coordination on this in this area. And in particular, there's a big role for the immediate response. The best way to deal with a pandemic is immediately emerges before it spreads around the world. What we really want is every country having the capacity, the domestic capacity or domestic capacity supported by the international community, to respond to pandemic outbreaks, you know, at source really rapidly, close it down there before it spreads across borders, before it goes worldwide. You know, if we'd managed that with COVID-19, you know, think of the lives saved, think of the trillions of dollars saved as well. So, you know, next time, I hope we get together as a global, before next time, I hope we get together as a global community and coordinate far more on thinking, how do we get instantaneous response to outbreak threats and really get the support to where they're happening in real time so that we can shut them down before they spread.
Just 30 seconds or so, Charles, you've immersed yourself in studying these scary diseases for 5+ years now. Did you come out of this feeling more optimistic or pessimistic about our disease future?
Optimistic. I have worries. You know, we could muck it up. We could allow new pandemics to spread. We could allow old infections to come back. But we've seen in the last 2 years, we've seen in the last 2 centuries, what we can achieve as humanity against these infections. And I think we're going to continue making that sort of progress. I certainly hope we do.
Charles, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on, Rob.
That's Charles Kenny, senior fellow at the Center for Global Development in Washington, D.C. We talked to him about his latest book. It's called The Plague Cycle, The Unending War Between Humanity and Infectious Disease. If you want to listen back to this full conversation or hear any of the discussions we've had on Central Time, you can find them all on our online archives. Those are at WPR.org, along with a lot more. Articles from WPR's news department, podcasts, and live streams of WPR's two networks. And we're always happy to hear from you. If there's an issue you think needs more attention on the air, or if there are people working on it in your part of Wisconsin, we want to know about it. You can email us at centraltime@wpr.org. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. That's the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin, in the 1962 song Respect, recently crowned number one in Rolling Stone magazine's list of the 500 greatest songs of all time. Rolling Stone created the original list back in 2004. Now, for the first time in almost 2 decades, they've updated it, replacing more than half of the list with new songs. Alexander Shashko is a lecturer in the Department of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison, frequent guest here on Central Time on All Matters Musical. Alexander, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. It's nice to be back.
This was a big update. A lot of turnover in these songs. As you look and compare the list, what were some of the big trends in the kinds of songs that came in and went out?
Well, I think in terms of the songs that came in, obviously you had a lot of new songs from the last 15 years or so, and that's not surprising since a lot of great music has been produced over the last 15 years, and it makes sense that they would be included. And then it's not just the songs from the last 15 years, but it's arguably the songs from kind of 1980 and beyond, which gain a little bit more traction on this list than on the previous list. And that makes a lot of sense, too, when you consider that the voters who are choosing these songs is always changing, and you have a generation of writers, critics, artists, and industry folks who are all coming from a younger generation than before, and so they're going to be more interested in the music of their youth or the music of their young adulthood, or maybe not so young adulthood, but they're paying attention. And so that really changes some of the dynamic of the list, and that is great. That's part of what these ever-changing lists are all about. I think you see an increase in the amount of hip hop, although we can talk in a moment about this, perhaps not as much as there should be. And I think there's a change in the gender ratio of the list, that there are more women on the list and there are more women near the top of the list. And that is a welcome transformation of the list as well. So those are all those three are sort of the big changes that I see on the list. In terms of the omissions, well, not surprisingly, some of the older music that was on previous lists has fallen off. In particular, a lot of the songs of the 1950s, some of which were really, really big songs, are no longer on the list or have dropped precipitously on the list itself. And you even have quite a few big anthems from the 1960s that either dropped a lot on the list or came off of the list. So that is one significant change. You also have, in general, a little more R&B, certainly hip hop, towards the top of the list, and some of the big rock songs that were at the top falling further down the list as it has changed over the years.
We got a taste of the new number one, Respect by Aretha Franklin. I want to give a listen to the old number one. It dropped to number four. Here it is. So Bob Dylan, Like a Rolling Stone, dropped from number one to number four. If there was a cliche, Alexander, of a Rolling Stone number one song pick, I think Like a Rolling Stone would be it. I remember there was a parody issue of Rolling Stone where it was Bob Dylan on the cover with Like a Rolling Stone reference. I don't know. What do you think about that change from what I would consider sort of the old model Rolling Stone top list to this one?
Well, I think the fact that you have three African-American artists at the top of the list is a recognition from the voters that African-American music is central to American music, that it is the foundation upon which all of this popular music is really built, R&B, soul, funk, rock and roll, hip hop, you name it. And I think that the change and the shift that you see on the list is attempting to acknowledge that in some way by putting these tremendous songs at the very top. Number four is no slouch for Bob Dylan, given especially that it came out in 1965. And I think that there has been a shift, certainly since the 1990s, in which, arguably even maybe a little earlier than that, in which rock and roll's central place in the story of American popular music has receded a little bit. And so my guess is that having it end up at number four is something of a recognition of that transformation.
Talking to UW-Madison's Alexander Shashko, looking at the new list from Rolling Stone magazine, the 500 best songs ever, as voted by a lot of people in the industry, musicians, music writers, and more. Alexander, if you were going to start rating number one songs, like, what criteria would you even start to do? I don't know how I would start. What would be at the top of your mind to try to pick and quantify the greatest songs?
Well, of course, it can't be quantified. So creating the numbers is always controversial by definition, since there's no true way to quantify this. But what I would say is that you'd want a song that caught people's attention when it happened. In other words, a song that has some kind of resonance in the moment that it was released, but also something that has stood the test of time, a song that continues to be resonant and popular over time. It's a song generally that is easily recognizable, something that folks don't forget, which is, of course, connected to it being resonant over time. You know, when you're starting to talk about elite songs at the very top, the music's got to be amazing and the lyrics have to be amazing. It really, one or the other is not going to cut it. And that's, I think, part of what unites all of the songs that are near the top of this list. And then, you know, the historical resonance is important too. Where is this song in terms of its deeper meaning in American society? And that's where the greatest part of this list comes in. And I do want to note that when the voters were asked to write these lists, they were asked to write their 50 favorite songs. And to me, that's a little bit different than talking about the greatest songs, and something does get lost in translation there. Now, I completely acknowledge that many of the voters may not have made that distinction in any meaningful way, but to talk about something that is your favorite is something that you particularly like or that you find, you know, sort of preferred over anything else, whereas something that is the greatest is something that you consider of sort of a quality or eminence that is above normal or above average. And I'm sure people kept that in mind as well, but I am a little curious about how the list turned out because folks were asked to list their favorite and then the list was promoted as being the greatest. And, you know, maybe the greatest really should be just what people like the most. But the historian in me, and that's of course what I do, has some questions about that, because, you know, to be a historian and to be a historian of music is also to acknowledge why a song matters, not just whether I love it.
It's Brianna, caller now at 800-642-1234. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. So I would say for criteria that it should, whatever the message is in the song should be more towards a timeless message, I feel personally. And because of that, I'd go with All Along the Watchtower, but Jimi Hendrix version, even though it was written by Dylan. And with the whole Dylan thing, I'm surprised that he didn't fall more, being that there's charges similar to, not as severe as the R. Kelly thing, but, you know, I wonder how much that's going to be taken into consideration, you know, moving forward for artists and stuff, too.
I'm not aware of the Dylan story, but a couple points there. First of all Along the Watchtower, the Jimi Hendrix version, cover of the Dylan written song, Alexander. I don't have the whole list in front of me because 500 songs, but I imagine right. A fair amount of people might put that up there.
Yeah, it's actually in the top 50. So it is, I think right around 45 or 40 or something like that. And it is a tremendous song. I mean, it's a song, again, that has incredible historical relevance to the Vietnam era, and the fact that it is written by Dylan and, you know, performed by Hendrix obviously makes it all that more power, much more powerful. And in fact, if you think about a lot of the songs that are near the top or in the top 50, one thing that I noticed is that quite a few of them are building off of the work of more than one tremendous artist. So Aretha's Respect, you know, was written by Otis Redding. Fight the Power, Public Enemy, is built off of a lot of samples, including the Isley Brothers. You know, they're taking the title from the Isley Brothers, Fight the Power. Smells Like Teen Spirit is inspired by the Pixies. So there are a lot of ways in which these songs near the top kind of have a little extra energy to them because of the way in which they are building off of the foundation of something that's already pretty great. And I think that All Along the Watchtower certainly fits within that category.
Let's go now to Katie with us in Sturgeon Bay. Katie, hello.
Hi.
What do you got for us, Katie?
Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, From the Beginning.
Yeah. So I got to say, I had the trilogy album. I wore the grooves out of that on vinyl when I was a kid. Why does that song stand out for you, Katie?
It was such a tumultuous time. I was a teenager when that came out, and just questions, why are we here? You know, the Vietnam War, of course, it was winding down, but it was a soul-searching song.
Interesting. Katie, I love that. Thank you so much for sharing that. And Alexander, I think this is going to be true for a lot of people. If you ask us our favorite song, it's going to have a lot to do with where we were and when we were when we heard it.
Absolutely. I mean, when you're young, in many cases, the music that you're listening to is part of how you shape your identity, your own sense of self. It's connected to deep memories that you may have of family or first experiences. And that only, you know, continues to happen throughout the rest of your life, even if it's not necessarily as profound as it is when you're young. So those personal experiences are absolutely part of what makes a song a favorite, right? What makes a song meaningful to any given person. And that's why this list changes, because as a different group of people are voting, almost no matter how much they're trying to think in terms of the broad sweep of history, their own personal biases, their own personal experiences are going to play into it. I mean, if they only ask you to pick 50 out of the 500, you're going to leave a lot of songs out that are important or even meaningful to you in an attempt to come up with a list. And that certainly is the experience I'm guessing that most of the voters had.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Alexander Shashko from UW-Madison. He's with us to talk about Rolling Stone magazine's update to their 500 greatest songs of all time list. You can join in with your greatest song of all time at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Share a song and why it's great to you. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, hear from more of you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Fight the Power there by Public Enemy, the number two song on Rolling Stone magazine's new list of the 500 greatest songs of all time. Alexander Shashko from UW-Madison stays with us, and you can share your pick, whatever standard you want to use for your greatest of all time. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go back to your calls now. Scott is with us in Franklin. Scott, hi.
Hi. I think a really good song that needs a nod here is Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen, having topped the charts at the time it was released, and then made it back up to number one again decades later because of its roles in some movies in the 90s.
Yeah, some staying power right there. And Scott, is it apart from the staying power, is it a personal favorite of yours?
It's definitely within my top 10.
Excellent. Thank you for bringing that up, Scott. The staying power, Alexander, it wasn't just a hit then, but it's something that came back maybe even for new generations.
Absolutely. And Bohemian Rhapsody's in the top 20. So I think that is confirmation of it. Yeah, exactly. That experience. The fact that the song has continued to emerge as a fan favorite time and time again means that different generations of listeners are experiencing it in a way that they find appealing, that they connect to in some meaningful way. And if you look at several of these songs near the top, certainly that is a similar kind of dynamic. Marvin Gaye's What's Going On is a song that continues to be resonant in terms of social movements. The same goes for Sam Cooke's A Change Is Gonna Come and Public Enemy's Fight the Power, for that matter. You also have a song like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams, which is in the top 10. And I don't think it's a coincidence that that song is particularly resonant right at this moment, that it has been viral on TikTok over the past year. Fleetwood Mac have been getting a lot of attention, and the song stands on its own. You know, there's no question it would be a song that would be somewhere near the top regardless, but it undoubtedly has been helped by the fact that it was in the air at the moment. And sometimes songs like that gain in popularity because of the second, third, or fourth life that they live.
Thanks a lot for the call, Scott, at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Amanda now in Green Bay. Amanda, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
What's your song, Amanda?
Oh, it'd have to be Bridge Over Troubled Water by Simon and Garfunkel.
And is that a song that's like had meaning for you, maybe even at different parts of your life?
Absolutely. Different meaning. You know, I was born in the 50s. I'm a child of the 60s. So certainly I remember when the song came out, but it's grown to take on different meanings through the cycle of my life. I'm now in my 60s. So it's a bit more poignant for me than it was when it first came out. I think in the beginning, I was just caught up by the amazing lyrics of Paul Simon and the soaring, gorgeous vocals by Art Garfunkel.
Amanda, thank you so much for sharing that with us. And that there it is again. Somebody earlier mentioned, Alexander, timelessness, something that isn't just of its time. And this is a song for Amanda that can take on new and different meanings as she goes through her life.
And I think that's a song that is particularly well suited to that, because Bridge Over Troubled Water is a song about friendship. It's certainly can apply to anyone who's thinking about a relationship, a romantic relationship, but it's also about friendship. It's about the people around you. It's about trying to help one another get up and get through. And that's something that you have to manage in every phase of your life, right? At every moment in your life, you have to think about how you're going to get to the next point, right? How you're going to get through the day. And that song has always provided that kind of comfort and reassurance to people. So it doesn't surprise me at all that it would fit into that kind of setting. God Only Knows by the Beach Boys, another example of a song that I think fits that kind of dynamic for people. So yeah, those songs that matter to people in their personal lives are really going to stick over time.
Amanda, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. We're talking to Alexander Shashko from UW-Madison, looking at the new Rolling Stone list of the 500 best songs of all time, updated from their 2004 list. Many, many changes. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us now in Milwaukee. Mike, hi.
Howdy. You know, I really love uplifting songs. So one of the songs that I was listening to a lot of rock and blues, and then I heard Van Morrison's Caravan on the Moondance album. Mm. And oh my goodness, what the beautiful production, the horns, the strings, the, in quotation marks, chick singers in the background. The chick singers happened to be Whitney Houston's mom and her aunt and another woman that were in the band and a group together. On that whole album, that's Whitney Houston's mom. And then also the Allman Brothers' Blue Sky with the gorgeous sound of the harmonizing Les Pauls. Oh my goodness. And then the lyrics are so just a beautiful, soaring, uplifting music.
Mike, you sound uplifted just like talking and thinking about those songs.
Absolutely.
I love it. Thank you so much for sharing. We seek out, Alexander, a lot of different things in music. Uplift, certainly up there. Do you see a lot of this kind of uplifting music in this top 500?
It's certainly there. I mean, you know, Van Morrison is there. Into the Mystic is on there. And that kind of represents, you know, a big part of what he has represented to fans for a long time, which is this sense of transcendence, right? This kind of getting to a higher place through his music and through the feel that his music presents. You know, a song as straightforward as I Want to Hold Your Hand by the Beatles, right? I mean, that's a song that just brings joy to people. Outkast's Hey Ya, which is in the top 10, another song that makes people happy, even though if you listen carefully to the lyrics of that one, it's not that happy, but it makes people happy to listen to it. So yeah, that sense of joy in the music is often what drives people to love music, right? It gives them an escape from whatever pain they might be feeling in the world. It gives them a sense of joy, entertainment, and of being able to experience something for a couple minutes that maybe gets you away from everything else going on in your ordinary life.
Thanks a lot for sharing those with us. We'll go to Liz now in La Crosse. Liz, hi.
Hi. I wanted to share the song All Too Well by Taylor Swift. I think she's really just someone who's really one of the greatest female artists of our generation, and she's come out with several new albums recently, and she's re-releasing the Red album that All Too Well is on. And I think she just poured so much heart and emotion into that song, and it's really one of my favorites of hers.
Thank you for sharing that with us, Liz. Taylor Swift appears on this, Alexander. I don't think she was around for the 2004 or not showing up there. Can you talk about Taylor Swift in our last minute or so?
Well, All Too Well is on the list. It's in the top 100. It's her highest ranked song on the list. She has two, Blank Space is the other. And, you know, that song is just a powerhouse breakup song. And, you know, I think what makes Taylor Swift so much a part of the canon already and likely to become more of the canon on whenever the next list is, is that she's a very classic songwriter. I mean, she writes melodies and she writes songs from personal experience, but that often have kind of universal themes, and the lyrics are often adaptable to other people's experience. And so, you know, she's obviously caught the attention of an entire generation of listeners, and without any question they've grown up with her and her music, and her music very self-consciously attempts to kind of gauge each of those eras and each of those phases of life. So you know, when a song makes the list from Taylor Swift, it's not just about the one song, but what she represents for all of those fans.
Thanks for the call. Alexander, a moment you may have been dreading. Can you give us a couple of the songs on your top 10 list?
Well, I thought about that. If I had to come up with three or four that would vie for number one, I'll be honest with you, Aretha's Respect would be right up there. Mm-hmm. I think it was a really great choice at number one. The others I would think about are The Message by Grandmaster Flash and The Furious Five. If you're going to pick a hip hop song, I think that's the one that I would put at number one, although Public Enemy, no slouch either. And then the other two I would consider are Johnny Be Good by Chuck Berry, because it's just so important historically, and Papa's Got a Brand New Bag by James Ooh. Brown, because it really transformed how soul and funk music would sound for decades beyond it. So those are the ones I would put right up near the top.
Love it. Alexander, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Alexander Shashko from UW-Madison looking at the greatest songs of all time. We'll go out with number 20 on the new Rolling Stone list, Robin and Dancing on My Own. This is Central Time.